Thank you so much, and thanks for people for being here physically and online. And it is a real privilege for me to be back in Berlin. The last time I was here, it was, well, there was a big wall running down the centre of it. It wasn't today or yesterday. It was a long time. And I think that's a graphic example of how Europe has changed a lot. And it is changing a lot. And the topic that we have before us is peace on the continent of Europe, question mark. And I think that's obviously fitting against the backdrop of a major war on European territory, the likes of which we haven't seen for decades. A confrontation that we were led to believe could never happen again, because for all of the legitimacy crises that the European Union has had, the scepticism over increasing centralisation and federalisation, fears about loss of sovereignty, resentment about lack of democracy, criticisms of power imbalance between larger and smaller states, concerns about economic liberalisation, privatisation and neoliberalism, and all the rest of it. Despite all of that, we were told that the European community and then the European Union helped to bring peace to a troubled continent. And, you know, we were told that where force of arms had failed and where there step in mundane things like customs and trade laws, the pursuit of a single market, this helped bring Europe together and made us dissolve our differences and bring peace. And isn't that great? Or so the story goes. And of course, like every story, there's an element of truth to it. But the European community came about in a continent divided by the Cold War, a division that obviously ran through this city. And the European community became the European Union at a time when the Soviet Union was dissolving. And I think it's fair to say that the economic liberalisation pursued in the Warsaw Pact countries, which involved, we'd have to say, social dispossession on a historic scale and laid the seeds of the present conflict. When you think about it, a lot of Eastern Europe was absorbed into the European Union for two reasons, really. One was NATO, to get them into NATO, and the second was to provide a pool of cheap labour for Western Europe. And they are, in some ways, the seeds of the conflict that we have now. You'd also have to say, of course, that Europe wasn't always peaceful for everybody, that there were vicious and bloody wars on the continent of Europe in the 90s and the 2000s, sometimes with the participation of EU members also. But overall, a Europe of peace and prosperity remained. There were no overt military conflicts between EU member states, and militarism and imperialist foreign policy wouldn't really be something that a lot of people would necessarily identify the EU with. They'd see it much more diplomatic, trade, cooperation, all this good stuff. And as an internationalist, of course, I believe in the possibility and the necessity indeed of a peaceful and socially just Europe. But I think we have to be really clear about this, that this ideal is dramatically at odds with the EU that we have before us and is actually irreconcilable with the warlike posturing that we see now, the path that the European Union is on. So at an EU level now, peace is a dirty word in Brussels and in Strasbourg. And instead what we have is the European Union politics gripped really by a frenzied enthusiasm for armaments, for militarism, for confrontation with our geopolitical rivals, for getting involved in regional conflicts in Eastern Europe, in Africa, in Latin America, in East Asia, and on and on. So the first point I'd like to make is that the war in Ukraine hasn't been the start of this, but it has actually put this process on steroids. And unless we understand that, we can't really come to an understanding of how peace will come about. And the creeping militarisation of the European Union has been going on now for decades. The concept of a European Defence Fund similar in some ways to an economic union or a monetary union, but this time with military and defence, has been actually a pet project of many influence in Europe for decades. But it really only came into being with the Lisbon Treaty, which got it right underway, because that treaty then made significant legal changes to how the European Union works. It cemented the European Union's foreign and defence policy and how that would take shape. So for the first time, it gave the European Union, if you like, a legal personality. It put things in like a mutual defence clause into the treaties, which meant it was now a legal requirement for all member states to come to the aid of any member state, for example, in an attack. And it's in the years since the Lisbon Treaty that the move to a European Defence Union has massively accelerated. Now, the Lisbon Treaty, of course, we should say, was also an example of the absolute contempt that the European establishment has for democracy, which they like to go on about a lot, but actually it's a big lie, because the Lisbon Treaty was a repackaged version of the failed EU constitution, which was rejected by the voters in France and in the Netherlands in 2005. And it was actually specifically redesigned in order to bypass the popular vote, because they knew that people wouldn't agree to something like that if they were given the choice. And uniquely, because of the Irish constitution and what we have, we're the only people in the whole of the EU who have to be consulted in any cases of treaty changes, which is actually a powerful tool. And ironically, during the Lisbon Treaty debates in Ireland, we had people contacting us from all over Europe saying, if you reject this, you're rejecting it for us. So it was actually profoundly European for us to reject the Lisbon Treaty, even though the political establishment in Ireland were embarrassed and ashamed that our people had let down the European establishment and who voted no. So they couldn't have that. Absolutely not. So they waited a year, they repackaged the same proposal, and with every bullying they could possibly design, forced through a vote this time round. And once Ireland was on side, then the Lisbon Treaty could go through. And one of the key reasons why the Irish voters rejected the Lisbon Treaty in 2008 was precisely because of militarisation, and precisely rooted in our neutral foreign policy. And I think one of the biggest problems when we try and understand the militarisation of the European Union is that a lot of the way the policies are designed are totally impenetrable. And that's done on purpose. Like, they're just an array, a sort of an alphabet soup of acronyms and institutions and agencies, and they all have their own roles and responsibilities, and very opaque and hard for a normal person to understand what that might be. So to bring a bit of clarity on that, I'll kind of divide these institutions, which are actually hidden in full public view behind all of this chaos. And we've kind of divided them for the purpose of tonight into kind of five parts. And the first one of these is armed forces integration. And this is something which came about from PESCO, which was the permanent structured cooperation, which Juncker called the sleeping beauty of the Lisbon Treaty. Lay dormant for a while, but then she woke up with all her glory, and it was activated in 2017. And really what it is a set of rules for joint military projects. And there's about 60 of them going on at the moment, which is not insignificant. Added to that, we have the fact that PESCO requires member states to spend on defence 2% of their GDP. They can also choose what projects they can participate in or not, as the case may be. So they say that might be something like a training project. It might be new military technologies or equipment, might be drones, missiles, warships. But the longer term aim of all of this is getting different armed forces to talk to each other, to cooperate with each other, to start setting common standards and begin to function like a single military vehicle. They say, no, it's voluntary, it's grand. You can have it if you like, but that's the direction in which it's going. The second area is EU missions, joint EU missions, which are deployed together abroad. Now, these are supposed to be restricted to humanitarian, disarmament, conflict prevention, military training and peacekeeping. Absolute and utter rubbish. This is modern colonialism repackaged, in essence. There is no good out of it at all. There's no democratic mechanisms. There's no humanitarianism. There are 21 active EU missions out at the moment. Just to give one example is the one on Mali. What in God's name is the European Union doing in Mali or the broader Sahel region? They say, oh, we're there to help. Well, actually, no, you're not. You're down there to advance EU and member state interests, to access resources, to police migration flows. It's been an absolute unmitigated disaster for the people who live there. It's had a massive knock-on effect in terms of regional conflicts and so on. They're down in Mozambique training soldiers in Mozambique. Seriously, Mozambique is down beside South Africa. What possible interest could the EU have down there? Well, the only interest they have down there is there's two lots of energy providers, one bunch of French corporations and one bunch of Italians, and they all want to get their paws on the resources of that African country. That's what they're down there for. It's not humanitarian at all. And not only that, they justify it on the basis that, well, the Russians are down there, the Chinese are down there, the Americans are down there. We have to get down there. When I think any right-wing person would say, would you all ever get out of there and leave Africa to the Africans themselves? But in any case, that's their second big area, is the foreign missions. The third area is the common European defence sector. Now, traditionally, military powers have their own defence industry. They have a kind of a symbiotic relationship with the state. We call it the military-industrial complex. But basically, this is a way in which the state finances arms companies. And the way the European Union got in on this act has been quite interesting over the past period, because how did the EU, which was never supposed to spend money directly on defence, end up spending money directly on defence and coming out of our budgets, basically free money to arms companies? Well, the backstory to this was in 2015, the European Commission said, now we need to get some advice on how we deliver security for the European Union. So let's consult some experts. So we'll set up this group of personalities, it was called. Now, it wasn't a bunch of celebrities or anything coming together. The personalities, believe it or not, were actually European defence contractors in the main. So you had Airbus, BAE Systems, Saab, Leonardo, blah, 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 the whole lot of them. And they put their heads together and said, now, how could Europe benefit going forward in a security sense? And they said, I know, Europe could actually spend some money on weapons and armaments and all of the good things that we produce. So they, surprise, surprise, they came out and said, actually, Europe, to be safe, needs to start spending a lot more money on weapons and defence. And that's exactly what they did. And the people who advised on that policy were the ones who benefited from those research contracts which were delivered in the first place. So we had in the recent budget, for the first time, the 2021 to 27 budget, defence being funded to the tune of 8 billion. Now, it was supposed to be a lot more than that, but obviously COVID ate into that a bit. But on the direct European defence fund, 8 billion euros of taxpayers' money being spent directly on defence. And that's separate to what all the member states themselves spend on defence, which is obviously many multiples more than that. On top of that as well, you have, of course, the available, this sets the tone for manufacturing across the union, because a lot of the money that's available for defence means that industrial policy across the EU means that small and medium-sized businesses are kind of being turned into the defence sector, dual-use products, as they call it, because that's where the money is. So products and services spring up for both civilian and military use. We see our universities who could be wasting their time on things like getting cure for diseases and stuff, instead researching more militarism because that's where the money is. And I remember raising it at one of the committee meetings, sort of saying, well, what's this? Like, I come from a neutral country, Ireland, and like, this is disgraceful that the budget of the European Union would be spent on this. And the person answering the question, don't worry, no. Irish companies will benefit from this as well. There will be many small and medium-sized Irish companies, but I say you're missing the point completely here, but that's how they marshal people into it. And we even saw that during COVID, where a lot of the activities which would be of a civil character in society responding to a dreadful crisis, they wanted a military aspect, they wanted the army mobilised to sort of deal with that. So we can see this militarisation everywhere. I think one of the more offensive areas as well, which would be, we kind of classify it as the fourth area, is where EU defence policy is jointly financing weapons purchases directly. Now, one of the new funds created, and it's very Orwellian title, is called the European Peace Facility. Now, the European Peace Facility actually replaced the African Peace Facility, which was a fund where Europe could go in and spend money in Africa on not too bad things, kind of like development and stuff. But the difference with the European Peace Facility is that it's allowed to spend money on weapons. So basically the plan was that you set up this fund, you go in, you use this European money to sell weapons to countries in Africa who would then get that money to buy European weapons from the same European country, probably have a bit of a war, civil war or whatever. Loads of their people flee from Africa, desperate to get out. The same companies that benefited from selling the arms are benefiting from the securitisation of the border to keep the refugees out of that. And that was called the European Peace Facility. It's off the books money for buying European weapons, in essence. And I have to say, I don't want to spend too much time on the Ukraine war. We will deal with that. But the Ukraine war has put this into overdrive. This is the vehicle now for billions upon billions of European money to be channeled into arms production. And a little bit like the US, where we see the same thing happening, when they say they're providing money for Ukraine, none of that money is ending up in Ukraine. It's all being spent and staying in America and being spent on American arms. The only benefit the Ukrainians are getting from it is that they're the ones dying, or Russian ordinary people are dying in that war at the end of it. So I think the last area that we kind of deal with is the defence planning. And this is called the European Strategic Compass. I find this one a real bit of a sickener now, to be honest with you. This is where we're all supposed to think the same. The Strategic Compass is supposed to be complementary to NATO. And there's been a lot of discussion over the years about will there be a European army or will there be NATO. And when Britain was in the European Union, big NATO fan, the UK, they were always going to stand in the way of a European army, weren't having it. Whereas the French had illusions, the French would have loved a European army, lovely. But now we have actually a peculiar situation since Britain has left, but NATO is in control now. But either way, I think it's a nuance, because the process of militarisation is the end goal, and that's the direction in which we're going in. And the Strategic Compass lays out for us who the enemies are, where the threats are coming from, what parts of the world the EU should get involved in, and makes recommendations as to how the EU and member states should harmonise and address those problems and challenges. And I remember in one of the early committee meetings when I got elected, raising this issue in the Parliament, when they were going on about how the Russians were coming at that stage, and the Russians were a threat, and I said, excuse me, I'm from Ireland. I really don't see how Russia is a threat to Ireland at all. And this Polish MEP sitting near me nearly burst a blood vessel. Now, this was a few years ago, apoplectic kind of thing. How dare you? He said, you were never occupied by Russia. You don't know what it's like, you know? And I said, fair point, colleague, you're right. We were never occupied by Russia. But we were occupied by a dominant neighbour beside us, and we were colonised for 800 years. And I don't see anybody arguing that we should rearm the IRA in a guerrilla war just in case Britain comes back and invades us again. Actually, what people said is we needed a peace process and we needed to engage in that. But that's what you're saying here, is we need to arm. But there's peace in Ireland and there's not now on the border of Poland. And my point is, I suppose, is that you can't have all that military expenditure, money that could be used for ridiculous stuff like, you know, health services or housing or education or better pensions and so on. People aren't going to buy that unless there's an enemy, a big bad wolf. And obviously Putin has given them that with his illegal invasion of Ukraine. But in many ways, they have created the monster that they're now afraid of because of the militarization there in the background. And instead of shouting halt, that the militarization of Europe has helped us to get to this point, the conclusions that's being drawn in EU quarters is actually the opposite. That we haven't defended ourselves enough. We haven't been militaristic enough. We have to go much, much more. More weapons, more defence. It's actually collective lunacy. Because once you have that, they have to be used. And that's sadly what we're seeing in Ukraine at the moment. I think alongside the increased militarisation, we've seen a sea change in terms of European Union foreign policy. The European Union is not a military superpower. It's very much subordinate to the US and NATO. But it is beginning to restyle itself, and language and behaviour has consequences. So the von der Leyen Commission called itself the first geopolitical commission and kind of started making moves about its ambitions to be a big player on the international stage. A lot of its strategy documents and reports and resolutions that we see talk about things like strategic interests or the need for the EU to ensure access to natural resources or protected supply or security provider, or talk about things like systemic rivals or whatever they are. They've entered the language now and they've been repeated ad nauseam. Now, that might have been okay like for former colonial powers, of which there are many in the European Union, but for other EU countries, we're never really on that page. And it is relatively recent that the European Union itself is a kind of a power centre for that type of rhetoric. And that should trouble us, because it does mean that the meaning of European integration and the future of the European project is shifting in that dangerous direction. And I think we see it accompanied by a very noticeable growth in European chauvinism. Now, for me anyway, I don't know, maybe it's different on mainland Europe, but for us in Ireland, I suppose European citizens have been sort of slow to buy into a sort of sense of Europeanness as opposed to sort of our own national identities. You know, I suppose where a European identity existed at all, it was kind of based on cosmopolitanism. It was kind of like, it was a nice fellow feeling for your fellow man or woman, people in different countries. It was kind of like a willingness to look past language barriers and differences and for all of us to work together. And it was kind of a nice thing to it. It was only really the far right that went further and sort of defined Europeanness as sort of white or Christianity and all of this sort of stuff. But we have to say it's changing now. Like, the EU identity is sliding into a very toxic type of nationalism, sort of defined by what it's against and what it's not. So the mainstream parties actually of the European Union in many countries have adopted the far right framing, if you like, around migration. And people coming into Europe are perceived as a threat to Europe. Europe has to be fortified against them. And we do see now the militarisation of Europe's borders. And as I said earlier, people being kept out to the benefit of the same companies whose arms destabilised their countries and made them refugees in the first place. We've seen horrific internment of refugees in appalling camps in many countries, the drowning of thousands of people in the Mediterranean, the enlisting of states like Turkey and Libya to prevent migration, and even talking about refugees and people as hybrid warfare and hybrid threats. That's how they categorise people. And I think language is not unimportant, and we do see a huge ramping up of the propaganda war. It's striking to me, even in the course of the 4 years of my term in the Parliament, we have now a common enemy. The Russians are coming. And that means absolutely dehumanising every Russian citizen simply because of their nationality, justifying discrimination and collective punishment. It's absolutely appalling. I've really seen nothing like it. And rather than examining the world in its complexity, there's an increasing ideological character to the way in which the European Union is engaging with the rest of the world now. So everything now is understood sort of as a sort of an ideological conflict between democracy and authoritarianism. That's all you need to know. That's what the war is about. And that's why we're involved. And that's why loads of people are suffering cold in Europe this winter, because we're in a battle against authoritarianism. I mean, seriously, authoritarianism isn't an ideology, you know. People don't wake up in the morning and say, what am I going to do to advance the cause of authoritarianism today? It's not an ideology, clearly. It's something that can creep into any political system. And the sad part about this is actually the European Union, in its proclamation of being democratic, is becoming more and more authoritarian. That those who speak out for a different narrative, who argue for peace, are being accused of being puppets of Russia or whatever. We see TV stations shut down because they're not buying in to the mainstream narrative. It's dehumanising and degrading people that they haven't a cop on themselves to hear two different interpretations and make up their own mind. No, they could not. They are the victims of disinformation and propaganda. I mean, it's off the absolute Richter scale. And every action of Russia or China is read with bad motive, malign intent, all that, while at the same time excusing similar behaviour by EU member states. But that's all grand. There's nothing wrong with that. So what we have actually is a huge Cold War style paranoia about foreign interference. They cannot get enough of this foreign interference stuff. It is morning, noon and night. It's imagined everywhere. And yet, in parallel to that, and without even seeing the contradiction, what the EU does is, well, no, we don't do foreign interference. No, we do democracy promotion. So we go in to other countries and do the same kind of things that they accuse them of doing for foreign interference. So we have European Union funded, state funded propaganda. We have NGOs, we have journalists, we have think tanks, all funded to undermine our opponent governments, doing exactly the same thing. But we've the moral high ground, because we, as Joseph Borrell, the High Representative of the European Parliament, said, the rest of the world is a jungle and we're a garden, and we need to protect ourselves from the jungle in case it comes in and encroaches on us seriously. And then they go on and talk about really issues which are universal values, human rights, rule of law, and they've transform them into being European values. They're not international law. No. They're our values. And we have an obligation to bring them to the savages. All human rights has been absolutely weaponized, and it is disgusting beyond belief. So they have a hell of a lot of things to say about countries that they don't like, who maybe, you know, stand up to their narrative. But then other countries who are just as bad, should I mention Qatar, etc., they get a free pass because they're not on that page. It really would absolutely make you sick, the hypocrisy that exists in this way. So I suppose the question is, what does all of this mean? And for me, it's that the EU sold itself on an idea of peace and prosperity. And despite the increasingly shrill rhetoric about democratic values, the truth is that the real EU is being unmasked in the present conflict in Ukraine, captured as it is by the military-industrial complex. I mean, I mentioned Qatar there, which is obviously the big scandal about MEPs being, in a very vulgar way, bribed by bags of cash by Qatar. And they're all, oh my God, how could this happen? This is terrible. But actually, the whole European Union is the victim of grand-scale lobbying. I mean, only before the Qatar scandal, the whole parliament was going to give Qatar visas, even knowing their awful human rights record, in return for oil. So it's the same thing anyway, it's just hypocrisy. And the gulf between the citizens of the EU and those in power is bigger than it ever was before. You look at the war, and I'm constantly struck by, seeing as we are in Germany, you would think that the likes of the Social Democrats would be kind of against war because they're supposed to be for social justice and that kind of thing. You'd think that the Greens would be, you know, because they're woolly little, you know, love the environment and all this would be. I have never seen hawkish behaviour equal anything than what I've seen from the German Greens, who are more hawkish than the most vitriolic anti-Russian Baltic states, who may have some element of reason for it. I don't understand the German Greens, but they are gung-ho on that. And unfortunately, I don't think the response of the left has been strong enough either. We maybe deal with that in a minute, but it is difficult. And the sad conclusion out of all of this is, where is this going to go and who's going to be the winner? It's going to be the far right, because they're the ones who are connecting with the economic pain being suffered by European citizens as a result, of the impositions of the sanctions. And I'm actually on a Ukrainian list for Russian propagandists. And my crime is two things. One is that I said that the sanctions affect ordinary people. And the second crime is that I said this is a NATO proxy war. So I'm actually quite happy to stand over both of those statements as demonstrably true, because people in Europe are suffering and they are looking for a way out of this crisis. And unfortunately, they're not getting an answer. And in some ways, the far right is connecting more. So I suppose the militarisation of Europe itself has moved us away from what the EU was supposed to be, playing a rational and a constructive role in world affairs, seeking diplomatic engagement with adversaries, attempting to defuse conflicts, treating our opponents in good faith, to now playing quite a negative role. Now the European Union is playing strategic games. It's actually raising tensions. It's instrumentalising third countries. It's striking aggressive postures that can only lead to escalation. And that is utterly tragic on the world scale. I mean, we had the benefit of going on a visit to Pakistan before Christmas, and a whole number of people, political actors and others, said it's so sad to see Europe just coattailing the US like this. Europe could have played a different role on the world scale, arguing for peace, being more down the middle. Why did it do this? It's sad. And it is incredibly sad. And I don't want to go into the details about the war in Ukraine. We can maybe deal with this in the discussion. There is obviously, you know, I'm not excusing Russia for crossing the line. They take full responsibility for that. They were in breach of the UN Charter. They should not have invaded Ukraine, but we have to take the background context into account and the role of NATO in destabilising the situation, in escalating tensions and so on. And unless we take that into account, we can't come to understand how we might get a lasting peace in Europe. So one of the things I think is the urgency of the EU's militarisation at the moment. I'm sure for people here, the step of sending the Leopard tanks to Ukraine was a new red line, and it was quite shocking in some ways. But actually, really what the EU is doing is sending just enough just enough to keep it going without tipping Russia over the edge. And that's the backdrop. And I think reading back over the series of crises that led to World War One and Two, I am really struck by how terrifyingly similar the present moment is. I mean, there's no obvious way out of this crisis. The path to military escalation kind of operates like a ratchet. Tensions can go up, they can stabilise, but they can't be really reduced. And the more things get entrenched, the more trapped we become in this logic of kind of escalation, the less agency then any of us actually have, or any government even has, in escaping this slide into ever greater conflict. So increasingly we have uncontrolled and unpredictable events which can push tensions higher, which can worsen relations, burn bridges for peace, push politicians and governments to overreact. And I think we are seeing now once in a decade events happening with great frequency. I mean, the sabotage of Nord Stream 2, the Kerch Bridge explosion, the tragic deaths of the rocket accident in Poland. Each or any one of those, and we have to expect more of these, is a possible trigger for a breakout war, a chain reaction that could bring new hostilities, an acceleration of the horror towards a generalised conflict. And, you know, I think that the overriding priority for progressive forces in Europe has to be preventing that from happening. That's the key, I suppose, to this talk. And, you know, we need to bring peace. And elementary as this statement is, it's made to sound like it's opposite, because since the invasion commenced, there has been an absolute hurricane of pro-war propaganda. And that's not accidental. I mean, you've probably felt it here, but it's emanating from strategic communication centres in NATO and amongst Western governments, all on message. So anyone who says don't send arms to Ukraine is leaving them defenceless. Same people never say that about Palestine. They never say send weapons to Iraq to defend themselves against US invasion. But suddenly now we have to send weapons to Ukraine. And all of the messages that you've been getting, the traditional media have been converted into really full-time propaganda organs for the pro-war narrative, actively misrepresenting arguments for peace, inciting hatred, dehumanising and ridiculing critical voices. I mean, I was a member of the Irish Parliament for many years and well known and so on, but we have been, along with Mick Wallace, we have been absolutely demonised for our anti-war stance. We're an embarrassment, we're a disgrace, the whole thing. I've never seen anything like it, and that's obviously replicated across Europe, but I know anti-war activists have got the same thing. So the first thing, I suppose, we have this really bizarre inversion of reality which has occurred, where political forces who supported every act of aggression, every crime against the UN Charter, every assault on a foreign country carried out by Europe and its allies have now reinvented themselves as the defenders of international law. So the same territorial integrity and sovereignty that they overlook in regions of Asia, the Middle East, North Africa, the Sahel, Central and South America are for the moment sacred and absolute principles now in terms of Ukraine. And those of us who have defended for our whole lives and still defend them in the present case, we're the revisionists, you know. Speaking up for peace now is support for the aggressor. Accepting nothing less than the military defeat of Russia, whatever that cost is supposed to be the only legitimate path to peace. I mean, this is an onslaught of propaganda, the likes of which we have never been exposed to. It is the product of US money invested in our media, in think tanks, in NGOs, plotted and dotted all about around the world and throughout Europe. And it puts the left in a very painful position, really, because the argument for demilitarization is a difficult argument to make now. And the propaganda war is designed to increase that pain, to increase the cost of peace advocacy and to cow people into silence. And sadly, that has been to a great extent what has actually happened. But, you know, these are the arguments that have to be made, and this is the exact time that they have to be made, because this is the time that the anti-war movement is needed most, when the continent is about to lurch into a reenactment of the horrors of the past. So we obviously don't choose the conditions in which we operate. Opposing militarism in Europe now is really inseparable from the conflict in Ukraine. The argument for an alternative international order in which conflicts like this are impossible can't be made without facing the war propaganda head on. By bringing anti-war constituencies together in Europe, buttressing support and building understanding for what's happening. How? Well, I don't have all the answers to that. Won't be a surprise for you to hear that. But I am lucky enough to have a platform, and that's what we're trying to do in the European Parliament for two things. One is to push for a wider conversation across the EU. That's why it's really good that we're having tonight's meeting and that we can engage in these ideas to convince people of the urgency of the situation and that there's nothing to be won by being timid. That's the first arm, if you like, in our weaponry. The second is that we do need a broader mobilisation and the intervention of the anti-war movement and anti-militarist forces. It has been cowed. Some countries are different, like, for example, Italy. It's been quite actually active. The anti-war movement has been pretty vocal there. Hasn't been bad in Greece. But given the scale of the tragedy that Europe is enmeshed in and the horrific loss of life and destruction in Ukraine, which is going on, and the direction we're going is just making sure it goes on, you would think that there would be a lot more people out in the streets. And maybe that's something that we can take in the discussion, because in my experience, I suppose two things stand out for me and give me hope in many ways. The narrative that's put out in the mainstream media is very one-dimensional. They've sown this pro-war narrative that we've addressed earlier, but that has not embedded itself in the hearts and minds of people. Every single day across Europe and beyond, we are contacted by people to say, fair play, thanks very much for speaking out the way you do. You're saying what I'm thinking. Some people say I'm actually afraid to say it in my job or in my place because people will jump on me and tell me to shut up, or I am saying it as well, and loads of people think the way you do. I mean, on any day, we've had interpreters coming up from the European Parliament sort of saying, I'm from wherever, we love what you're doing. I've met fellas in the airport saying, I work in the European Commission. You know, there's loads of people who actually think like you, fair play. And then just ordinary emails from ordinary citizens who are not linked to the European institutions to say, has Europe collectively gone absolutely mental that we're shooting ourselves in the foot to continue a war that we're suffering on, that the people in Ukraine, the people in Russia, everybody is suffering on? Why isn't anybody demanding an end to this madness? So that message is in the heads of a majority of people. I'm 100% clear that that's the case, because they're in touch with us all the time, every day. So what we have to see is, how do we get that silent majority, because they most definitely are, to make their views known and impose their views on those who are in power? And that's really, I suppose, where we're at now. Sadly, I think because of two things that will begin to change. The first one is the economic hardship being experienced by ordinary Europeans will force people to take action and take to the streets, because they are the ones whose living standards are, if you like, being damaged by this war continuing, by our sanctions and so on. And the second, I suppose is one of the main reasons why I think people will take action is because of that. I mean, genuine military strategists know that there's no realistic military victory for either side in this conflict. And really, I suppose there's a ferocious refusal to allow that knowledge become general knowledge. They say, no, Ukraine has to win. The idea that nobody's going to win in a war is not popular. We have to fight to make that general knowledge. And I think we must make it clear that we want Ukraine to survive as an independent and a sovereign country. And that's the course that Europe is taking, actually, is going to deliver the opposite of that. It's ensuring its destruction. So I think we have to be to the foreground about the dire social consequences of this war, the displacement of millions of people, the slaughter of a generation of military-age men, the ugliness that conscription efforts and the crippling debt that Ukraine is being saddled with, permanently removing its sovereignty for any future Ukrainian government and people in the name of preserving that sovereignty. I mean, it's absolute and utter lunacy. That country is being put up to be sold off to the vultures in the wings. And I think we have to counteract attempts to make peace harder to achieve and continually bring conversations back to halting the slaughter, ceasefires, negotiations. Why is an armistice not among the possible options being discussed? Why? Like, would the promise of a Ukrainian neutrality and no admission to NATO have been a greater infringement of Ukraine's sovereignty than what's happening now? Could something like Minsk II and a return to neutrality achieve a withdrawal of the Russian forces? Can any of these questions be answered without dialogue or diplomacy? Of course they can. So what we need to do is take possession of the EU's peace myth and turn it to the actual benefit of the peace movement. I think we need to argue for a system in Europe of collective security, free from the old and new divisions. We need to make clear over and over again that stability and peace in Europe can only be achieved through peaceful conflict resolution, through arms control, and through disarmament measures. That's not easy. It does mean taking on the vested interests at the heart of the European Union in big business and the military industrial establishment, but it is the only way in which we can do it. And, you know, I think we should take great solace from the fact that while the narrative is being very much framed in the context of the West or the White West of Europe, America, Australia and Canada, the majority of the world's population lives in countries who get it, who want peace and want a multipolar world where countries are respected and different traditions are respected. So that's the new international world order that we strive towards. That's where the battle in Europe lies. I think we know, and most people know, that the people in power have misused it, and our chance now is to use that to shake them up, to take them on and argue for peace and a real Europe of equals rather than one of neoliberal exploitation and militarism. That's the task. It's not an easy one, but that's the road that's open to us. So thanks so much for allowing me to share those few points tonight.
Thank you very much, Claire. Let's start with questions. We'll take them from the audience first. I just wanted to mention, if you're on YouTube, we already have the first questions from YouTube as well. You can send them over in German or English. The same here. If you have questions in German, we'll translate them into English for Claire. So let's start here. Do we have any questions?
Easy ones now.
I know you were preparing one. Yes.
Du müsstest in das Ding sprechen, weil damit das die Leute online hören.
We'll share. We'll do one for the audio and we'll share. Yeah, sorry.
Horst Scheibe, ich habe eine Frage. Wofür hat die EU eigentlich den Friedensnobelpreis bekommen? Und zweitens ist es keine Frage, sondern eine Ergänzung. So viel, wie Sie erzählt haben oder erlebt haben in der im Parlament, kriegen wir ja gar nicht mit. Und vor ein paar Jahren kam der Film in die Kinos Europa, ein Kontinent als Beute. Der hat ausführlich dargelegt, wie die Amerikaner schon seit Jahrzehnten Europa missbrauchen für ihren als unsinkbaren Flugzeugträger. Die Russen, die leben in Europa. Die können nicht woanders hin. Und die NATO, die hat, wurde ja damals gesagt, dass sie sich nicht an den Osten ausdehnen wollen. Da hat der Herr Stoltenberg, der schon seit damals regiert hat in der NATO, dieser Mensch, irgendwann gesagt, es gibt Sachen, die halten nicht ewig. Und die Amerikaner führen Kriege rund um die Welt und kein Mensch denkt an Sanktionen oder macht Sanktionen und nimmt seine Völker als Geiseln, wie jetzt hier gegen
die...
Die eine Frage war einfach, why did the European Union receive the Nobel Peace Prize? That was actually the question.
Wow. Well, I suppose... Obama got it as well, so I mean, there's a fair bunch of warmongers now who've got that. It's a kind of probably a misnamed prize, probably like the European Peace Facility. It's actually a European War Facility. So maybe the Nobel Peace Prize is the more you can do to destabilize the world is how you get it. I mean, we've had some of them. As I say, Obama got it. He's a war criminal, as far as I'm concerned, but. They should never have got it. It's become really politicised, and unfortunately now a whole number of international organisations have become politicised and debased of their multilateralism, really, and also it's undermined the value of the Nobel Prize. I think it's meaningless if the European Union can get it now. But it shouldn't have been, it needn't have been like that. I mean, the week before the Putin invaded, Schulz was saying, we can't have peace in Europe against Russia. We can only have peace with Russia. And he was actually right. And then sadly, criminally, once Putin did cross that line, which was disgraceful and appalling, and they're totally responsible for that. But then it went completely flipped over the other side. And now we are where we are. It's just crazy. But... you know, there was a tentative peace agreement between Ukraine and Russia in April of last year, but the European powers didn't want that. They wouldn't let them sign off on that. They didn't have Ukraine's back on that. We want you to fight on, basically. And I find it so offensive that discussions in the European Parliament, we have deputy after deputy getting up and basically arguing for Ukraine to fight on to the last Ukrainian. They're serving a death sentence to all Ukrainian men nearly. Go and fight. Like I it's terrible. But they're not doing the fighting and they're not doing the dying, like, you know, and they're not in any way sitting around for peace. So maybe the fact that, I don't know, that the line has been crossed here with Germany escalating its involvement, whether that will be the trigger for the anti-war movement here to say enough. Now we've got to take this on. It's a step too far. I don't know. Maybe it will. I don't know what other people think. Because for me at the start, we had high hopes that maybe Germany or France would argue for a different path. A bit like the way in which, I know it didn't work out in the end, but around Minsk too, France and Germany did play a positive role. There was a bit of sanity in their diplomatic dealings, and diplomacy, of course, is always about talking to the people you don't like and negotiating. And they were a bit sane, but now that's all gone now. Now they've gone completely lunatic. And I remember saying to some German MEPs, I always thought that even as a sort of even German capitalism, for its own economic interests, would step in and say, we can't go down this road of sanctions and hurting ourselves. Why are they doing this? Like, the damage that's been done to the German economy doesn't make sense for Germany even, apart from the people, because ordinary people always lose in a war. And the answer back from those MEPs was, they're afraid. Businesses did try and speak out in the early days, and anybody who spoke out was absolutely and utterly just buried. And then they became afraid to speak out. But, like, and I understand that. We experienced that as politicians across the board in the different countries. It's certainly horrible. It was something I haven't experienced on that scale in my political life. I know colleagues had their houses targeted and signs written up on it and horrible things happening, but this has scary memories of what happened on the continent of Europe many decades ago, and here we are again, you know. And it's interesting that, I suppose, in World War One and the collapse of the Second International, the Socialist Internationals, and all those big parties of workers, once the war started, they all kind of collapsed. And we've had a little bit of that now. But it's beginning to change. But sadly, it's beginning to change after 15 million of Ukrainians have been displaced, the country is destroyed, thousands are dead, tens of thousands of soldiers dead, and there's no end in sight. It's just, they're just cannon fodder. Like, we've had Ukrainian students contact us who were studying in Europe, and they were very grateful that Europe opened its universities to help them, and now they're being locked in the country. They can't leave. And when we appeal to the European countries, these young men want to pursue their education. They don't want to say, Ukrainian authorities say they can't leave. They must stay. They must fight. Same thing is happening in Russia. So a generation of people, they don't want to be fighting in this. It's just terrible. Anyway, that's straight from your question. Sorry.
Any other questions here? All right, I'll move on. We can get back to you.
Maybe you can take, there are three.
Yeah, I have them here.
Similar. Maybe you can combine them because they're all related to Ukraine.
Oh, we'll just start with them. Do one at a time. You clearly speak of the need to support the resistance with resistance to arms supplies, Frank. Why do you ignore the arguments put forward by the Ukrainian and Russian left against your position?
What was the first one?
That was one. There's three. There's two more to come. I've just done the first one.
Are they three or two? Okay.
Start with one at a time. We'll work through the list.
Yeah, but they're very similar.
Okay. So second one is, how can we practice solidarity with Ukrainians and support a position of self-determination while denying their request for more weapons deliveries? And third question, what do you say to the Ukrainian left, including socialists, who are asking for support, solidarity, and weapons? How do we respect their agency in this conflict?
Well, I mean, I think there's no block view on that. I mean, I don't know who's defining what Ukrainian and what Russian left has been spoken of here. I don't know. I do know, for example, the Ukrainian trade unions have spoken out and been very concerned about the absolute decimation of workers' rights and the changes in labour laws in Ukraine. And I think we have spoken out on that in solidarity in the Parliament, that workers' rights should be respected. In Ukraine, we've spoken on the side of the opposition parties who've been banned in Ukraine, many of them imprisoned, and indeed pacifist forces have come to Ireland, Ukrainian pacifists who don't want any decisions. So people have different views, and there may well be people on the left. I mean, depends what you call the left. I mean, would people call the social democracy in Germany on the left, and they're supplying arms to Ukraine? So maybe there are people who define themselves as left in Ukraine who want arms. My point is the arming Ukraine has been what has gone on over the past year, and look at the result of that, arms and sanctions. And the definition of madness is doing the same thing and expecting a different result. So the European Union ratcheting up a strategy which it's been engaged in, it can only lead to further conflict from Russia. Do people seriously think that by sending in the arms now that Russia will say, okay, so we'll back off? The only way in which Russia will back off, and I believe they need to exit the Ukrainian territory, and I respect the right of Ukraine's sovereignty and its independence, it's actually in deference to that. And to secure that, we need to bring about an end to the war as soon as possible. And arms and sanctions have not done that. They've only ensured that the conflict have continued. So a different way has to be tried. So I would say I respect the sovereignty and the of the Ukrainians who reached a deal, a tentative deal with Russia last year. I think it's really regrettable that they weren't allowed to complete that deal, that they had to fight on and fight Russia further than that. That's very regrettable. The European Union should have had Ukraine's back at those discussions and said, okay, we'll go in and we'll go behind you. I mean, the Russians know that the EU has Ukraine's back, if you like, on that. So go and talk. Let's have an armistice. Let's go down and sit down. That hasn't been tried. The arms and sanctions thing has been tried and it's failed. What's wrong with that? To me, that's the best protection of Ukrainian sovereignty, because people talk about, but Ukraine can win. I'm not being funny about it. That's an absolute nonsense. Nobody will win in this war. Any US general, any serious commentator on this subject, let's take away the moral sort of fluffiness around this. There is no victory for either side in this. There is only an endless war. And the only way of ending that is by taking the arms out of it, by taking the row off the battlefield into the negotiating table. So, I mean, there may be people on the left, and there's people who are on the left here who would say put more arms in. It's not my opinion. But isn't it good that we are having this discussion? And isn't it tragic that these issues aren't being teased out in the mainstream media to say, I'm not saying I have all the answers, this is my opinion, but shouldn't we tease out what might be the best way forward? And that's one of the saddest things about this conflict, is we have an authoritarianism now where we're not allowed to hear these views at all, you know? Probably didn't answer half that.
But, it didn't worry about it.
Did it?
Oh, you did, okay. Actually. It's okay. A very broad question.
I agree with your main thesis.
Wait. You have to talk.
Sorry.
You have to talk here because otherwise people...
You have to come towards us.
I try to speak in English.
And you're brilliant.
I agree with your main theme, thesis that the military industry in Europe is growing since the Lisbon Treaty. But I can't explain the actual policy of the German Foreign Ministry, Baerbock. Because in contradiction to the most general, the general inspector of the U.S., who actually said at the moment, the war is not a win for never for the NATO or Ukraine and never for Russia. We have to de-escalation. And the RAND Corporation just actually said the same. But Baerbock is, on the other hand, said we have to, was heißt besiegen auf Englisch?
Conquer.
Huh?
Conquer. Yeah.
To conquer Russia. And that's a contradiction. And I have a comparison. I remember if Joschka Fischer in 1980 became foreign minister, he was very the same opinion with his U.S. colleague Albright in the war against Yugoslavia. And this is for me a parallel. In the moment, Baerbock is and the Green Party is very strong alive with one part of the U.S., not the whole member of the general of the military are we have to stop it, but another people, other part in the geostrategy, they want to accelerate because the main war is against China. And the result of the Ukraine war is that U.S. and Europe is very stronger than every time. Macron had said 2017 the NATO is death. And what wie kam das zustande?
How did this develop, this situation?
God.
It's a lot.
There's a lot of things, and my German history wouldn't be great, but yeah, I mean, there does seem to be a thread going through the German Green Party, because I think they were the people who put the Luftwaffe back up in terms of Yugoslavia and that as well. And for a lot of young people, it's shocking to me to see the behaviour of the German Greens in the Parliament. They are right out there on the extremes, you know, and if you even think about it, the amount of young people who delivered so many Greens into the Parliament, and actually the battle to save the planet is the biggest challenge that we face as a society. But this war has resulted in the European Union standing on its head many of its environmental policies. I mean, coal mines are being reopened again. We're importing filthy, fracked US LNG and so on. So environmental concerns are being devastated by this war, yet the German Greens, the person whose name I cannot pronounce, absolutely riding full scale behind it, as you say, against the advice of sort of US militarists and so on, who are a bit more sober about it. Why is that? I don't know. Presumably Germans would be able to answer that better than me. I think overall, in terms of the EU, was sort of, they called the US their like-minded partner, and they're going to have the US's back in the war with China. But actually, that's complicated as well, because China is the European Union's biggest trading partner now. They're of critical importance to them. So they're kind of playing a bit of a middle of the road there, not to mention the fact that, of course, the US stabbed them in the back with their Inflation Reduction Act and the protectionism that it brought in on its energy projects, which left the EU massively exposed. So we have the spectacle now of European governments making decisions on energy and, say, in Germany's case, refusing to buy Russian oil and gas, and instead Europe is paying four times the amount that US buyers are paying for US LNG. Now, if that's the way our like-minded friends treat us, we're being absolutely shafted, and it's the poor people and the ordinary people in Germany who are paying the price of that, saying, no, you can't buy that from Russia, so you have to buy it from us, and you're going to pay four times the amount of what we sell to our people. Now, if the German government can't turn around and say, I mean, I'm embarrassed for them. I mean, Schulz seems to be an incredibly weak character, torn between different, I don't know, sections in his party. He can't seem to get it together, but he must know that's not in Germany's interests at all. And I mean, this might be really controversial at a left-wing meeting, but sure, look, we'll do it. And politically, I wouldn't have any time for her, obviously. But I honestly don't think that the war would have happened if Merkel was still in power here, because Merkel always put Germany first, German capitalism obviously first. And it's in the interest of the European Union to have a strong Germany. You know, she wanted a strong European Union because Germany gets the most out of that. And look at it now. I mean, I don't know. You like a bit of controversy. I wouldn't have voted for her if I was here, Germany is going to pay one of the heaviest prices out of this conflict, which is one of the reasons why I think the far right will benefit, because they'll play on that a lot. I just find it utterly tragic. But, I mean, you ask me why are the Germans like that. You can see the logic in a European context, but not in Germany. I can't see the logic in a German context either. I mean, I cannot in any way see how anybody could justify how this would be in Germany's interests. Actually, what they've done is weakened Europe massively, and Germany has benefited from Europe being strong because it's been run really in the interests of Germany. That's a different row, but it's suicide. And people in the parliament, we just shake our heads, say, how can this happen? And people around the world are saying, how is this happening? What is Europe doing? Have they gone completely mad? The rest of the world, which looks on, and the rest of the world, which contains a majority of the world's population, who are completely opposed to this war as well, but who understand just, oh, Putin is bad, Russia is bad, it's not a solution to the conflict. They all are looking on and saying, what's going on? But I don't know. You've some elections on here. I don't know if they'll change anything, will they? What elections are on here? There's posters up.
Just for the state of Berlin on the 12th
of February. Oh, it's just council things, right, so that won't get rid of any of them.
No. Yeah.
Okay, scary, but...
All right. Hi, Claire. First off, thank you so much for your work. Have you witnessed lobbyists influencing MEPs in the parliament, and what is your experience on US interests guiding EU policy? Then there's this... take that one first. So the next one's about China.
Yeah, I mean, lobbying is everywhere. in the European Union. I mean, there are 60,000, I think, official lobbyists in 12,000 officially registered lobbying countries, companies, and they've all gone into overdrive now about lobbying from foreign actors. To me, I don't care where the lobbying is coming from. It doesn't bother me if it's coming to, if a Qatar fella is benefiting, or an American fella, or a Chinese fella, or a Russian fella, or a German, Irish businessman. It doesn't really matter. If they are interfering and buying favours, well then, that's untoward. And the sad thing is that actually a lot of, I suppose, US lobbying is done as a matter, in the same way as a lot of mainstream European Union capitalist country lobbying is done, is it's actually ingrained in the psyche of people. It's not considered to be lobbying. That's the way we do it. Shall we just do business with the US anyway, don't we? Because they're our like-minded friend. So when they contact us, it's not lobbying. So it's right across the board. They're registered. We can see it in many, many votes. So you see all the operators, the military industrial complex, big agri, big pharma, they all come in when the various votes are on. And the foreign players are more targeting the parliament now, probably because the parliament can kind of has a role in trade agreements and so on. So yeah, it's all the time. But like, you know, as I said, in terms of Qatar, they're on a big moral outrage about MEPs taking big bags of money on Qatar, which is obviously disgusting, and they should be held to account for that. But the same people were quite prepared to give Qatar free visas and all that kind of stuff in return for oil. What's the difference? Where's the moral? So it goes on, and the US are everywhere, US think tanks. And one of the things, just very briefly, I'm on the Committee for Foreign Interference and Protecting Democracy in the European Union or something. I don't know, it's called something like that. I don't know, that's the wrong name for it. But anyway, they bring in experts all the time. Every single one of those experts is from a US Endowment for Democracy, National Endowment for Democracy, US-funded think tank, and they present. And I'm not saying those people aren't entitled to their views. They are, but it's not a neutral view. And they're the ones who are brought in. So that's where it is. So that's accepted as not propaganda or not influence, but it is. So that was kind of, yeah, it's there. But am I corrupted by it? No. But they'd all say that, wouldn't they? Yeah. Yeah.
So was the decision of NATO being on board towards escalation on China already made? I ask because no voices from EU were heard to calm the situation when Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan, and strong Chinese objections.
Yeah, we tried. I mean, that was an outrageous provocation again by Nancy Pelosi, which even whether he meant it or not, but Biden himself said, don't go there. It was a bad thing to do. China is an interesting one. There are hawks in the European Parliament who come out with the most appalling anti-Chinese rhetoric all the time. Borrell, the High Representative, is a bit more cautious, to be honest. The soundings from the EU establishment is a little bit more coy on China. They're not as anti, well, they are and they aren't. It's a kind of a contradictory one. The MEPs in the Parliament might unleash some sort of anti-Chinese rhetoric and there'll be a fair bit, but I think in the Commission they fairly know that the scale of the trade and engagement that they can't really cut off all links with China. The problem is that there is no doubt that Taiwan is being set up as a sort of a Ukraine part two, that the interference and the destabilisation that we saw in Ukraine over the past decade is being replicated now in Taiwan. And yeah, that is a bit scary. So, you know, US and EU naval vessels in the South China Sea talking about going down and protecting that area that's nowhere near their backyard is provocation. Bringing in and closer ties with the likes of South Korea, Japan, we see the world coming into blocks and blocks being formed, which is really unhelpful, and the EU is playing its part in that, sadly. So we tried to speak out against it at the time. But it was bad. Like, a European Parliament committee even visited Taiwan, that foreign interference. I mean, this is the irony. The Committee on Foreign Interference in the Democratic Processes of the European Union, that's what it's called, went on a visit to Taiwan in the middle. They'll talk about interfering in another country, which you shouldn't have, which they've no right to do either. They went on a visit to ratchet up there, but yeah. It's the next big confrontation, no doubt, if they ever finish with this one.
Sure, I can ask a question.
Yeah, come and speak into the microphone,
easy one,
please.
First of all, thank you, Claire, for your talk this evening. I really enjoyed it. Keep holding truth to power. Doing a great job. Maybe we can go controversial again. I wanted to ask you your opinion on Nord Stream 2. What your colleagues in the European Parliament are talking about it. Nobody knows, of course, but I just don't see it being Russia. And if it isn't Russia, if you also think that, just how important that is in terms of a German piece of infrastructure being attacked, which they spent billions on, is owned by this, well, part owned by this country. And yeah, why there just isn't more talk about that? I would put it down to the media controlling most people's thoughts, but just your opinion about what happened with Nord Stream 2, why it's not a bigger story, not only in terms of an attack, but also the environmental damage that it caused. I know Mick does talk about it also. I've seen some of his talks, but yeah, if you could just talk a bit more about that.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's a really good question, and isn't it amazing how much we're all prisoners of the media, the fact that we're not banging this drum often enough. Like, one of the biggest actions of environmental sabotage, for nothing else, massive, massive environmental damage, and then the huge economic sabotage that was done there. Why would Russia do that? If they wanted to cut off the gas, they'd just have to turn it off. Do you know what I mean? They didn't need to do all that environmental damage, and that doesn't actually make any sense at all. But as you say, Germany funded that. So I don't know who did it, and I can't say who did it. But the biggest question is why aren't people demanding answers, and why isn't there a big international investigation? And the clue is kind of in that, because they probably do know the answer and they don't want it coming out. That's all we can say, and that's all we can keep banging on to get answers on it. But it doesn't look like we're going to get it. But it's that, I mean, even that, like, when you look at all the money that German taxpayers put into that for something that is a cleaner source of energy and a cheaper source of energy than what you're paying for now, and no one's even wants to know what happened to it. And you've the Greens in government, and then you kind of go, oh my God, this is scary stuff. And it's really frightening how they can kind of shut down the discussion. So people forget. There's so many things that we're kind of faced with that you have to keep reminding yourself that happens. So look, I don't know. I think it would be highly unlikely that it would be Russia. I know there's active, you know, sort of who could do it and who was in the area, and the speculation is US, UK, Poland, I don't know. But I think it'd be completely mad if Russia did it. It doesn't make any sense. But I do think you're right. We need to keep returning to that project. There was actually discussion in the Parliament there, I think it was before Christmas, around those lines, kind of saying, why isn't it? It was actually tabled by the far right, and we participated in it and fully structured in it. But it kind of goes to show that's the only area where questions are being asked.
Mm. So last question. Given as an example the extremely big media noise and support for the German government's position of unstopping weapons deliveries, all right, how can the big, and according to anecdotal evidence, maybe even bigger share of the population who sees this differently, make its position listened to? So I guess the question is, what can we do?
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know enough in terms of Germany, but I would think that because the line has been crossed in some ways in terms of the tank situation, that there must be more conversation now about the war than previously. I was struck by the Nick Dunser-Krieg graffiti and all that. I mean, you wouldn't get that in Brussels, really. It's been very much, it's been a hallmark of sort of Italy all the time has been, we stand for peace. And, you know, you wouldn't see we stand with Ukraine. They'd say we stand for peace, which used to be the traditional sort of thing. But I thought it was striking that actually there is a lot of graffiti here, so things must be changing. I think there is no way around it. People have to sort of begin to take to the streets. They have to have fora like these, discuss the issues with their friends in their schools, popularise, I suppose, the ideas of peace. The audience for receiving it is getting bigger, but it's not big enough. Like, I mean, I don't know what the situation is in terms of the trade unions here or stuff like that, or how organised they are. There's been obviously huge movements in France against the pensions and stuff. That's going to have an impact on their government. There's been big anti-war protests in Italy and in Greece, mainly of the EU countries. But even Ireland, it hasn't been as prominent as it should be. But any anti-war activity that can be done in terms of leaflets and events, that's a way of building it up, and it will change. Sadly, it'll change because the tragedy of the war continuing is going to have to force people to make a stand, you know. So that's not a neat, it's not a good answer, because I don't have a magic wand on it or a magic solution. There is no easy solution. You just have to talk to your friends. You have to talk to your workmates. You have to challenge the narrative everywhere you can and take confidence of the fact that actually you are the embodiment of what the majority of people think. So if people shout you down or if the media is telling a different thing, you're that silent majority, and you know that you have to just take faith from that. And remind yourself that on a global scale, we're the very active majority of people support peace and a diplomatic resolution at UN level and all of that as well. So any pushing in these quarters will help. I don't know if you have any elections coming up or if there's any way of changing your government, but that'd be a help as well, you know. Yeah.
All right, Claire, thank you very much. We're going to stop here because the translators are exhausted by now.
I'm sure they are, and I'm so sorry. I hope they could understand my
accent. No, it's all right. It's all right. It's an hour and a half. That's how much they usually can
fair
take.
Play.
Thank you very much, Florian and Oscar, for doing this.
Thank you, Sean.
Also, Sven Buchin, who's accompanying us through the whole technical intricacies of this, and Frank, as I said, and thank you for all those who came and all those who viewed. And I hope we'll see each other again on the 2nd of March, Thursday, with Wolfgang Streeck.